I'm Vermont Edition producer Sam Gail Rosen. This podcast has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. A few years ago, I visited the Rock of Ages Granite Quarry in Barrie with Todd Patton, who works for the Rock of Ages company, and he took me up above the quarry to see the deposit they're mining.
This is kind of amazing looking.
It's quite a large site, isn't it? It's called the Depot Quarry. It's an older method of quarrying. You can say it's a large cavernous hole and very, very deep.
How long can you continue to quarry the stone here? When would it run out?
They've been quarrying continuously on this site since 1880. The deposit of granite here is called a pluton, and it's been measured using sound technology. MIT measured the deposit at approximately 4 miles long. It varies somewhat in width, but about 2 miles on average wide. It's about 10 miles thick, and at current recovery rates, there's another 4,500 years worth of stone in the ground.
That's a lot of granite. Granite is one of Vermont's three state rocks. Yes, we have three: granite, marble, and slate. Each is prominent in the state's geology, but also each has played an outsized role in shaping Vermont's history and culture. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to learn more about all three of these rocks. Guiding us through the conversation, maybe like a vein of quartz, is Charlotte Mertens. She's a geology professor at UVM, and it's a pleasure to have you back, Professor.
Thank you.
So, can you give us a quick overview of Vermont's geology insofar as these three rocks are concerned, where they're found and what they contribute to what we think of as Vermont's landscape?
These three rocks generally all formed at about the same time in Earth history when the Green Mountains were being formed, about 450 million years ago to about 350 million years ago. And the slate and marble are metamorphic rocks, which means they've been changed by heat and pressure from some original rock, probably sedimentary, like a shale or a sandstone or a limestone. They've been changed by heat and pressure into their current form as slates and marbles. The heat and pressure that generated these rocks is associated with colliding plates that upthrust and uplifted the Green Mountains, which at the time were about the size of the present-day Andes Mountains in South America. The granites are a little bit younger in this story, as that same plate collision that uplifted the Green Mountains about 450 million years ago continued in a series of waves, if you will, culminating about 350 million years ago with the actual collision of another continent on a plate, parts of the British Isles, with this corner of North America, and tremendous heat and pressure generated from this continent-continent collision created the igneous rocks that are present in Vermont as the Barrie granite pluton. So you can think of that granite as the plumbing system beneath a large volcanic system. And as your tour of the quarries described, it's a very large, a pluton is the technical name for this very large magma chamber that existed beneath a volcano. So these three state rocks are really representative of a very dynamic period in the history of Vermont of colliding plates and tremendous alteration of the landscape.
It's interesting that slate and marble, in the way you describe it, are sort of more closely related, because I think of marble and granite, perhaps because of their uses and because of how hard they are, as more closely related, and slate being the outlier, but that's not the case.
No, it's not. Actually, we can look at these rocks in terms of usage, which seems to be the direction you were going on. But if we look at them in terms of how they form and the physical properties they have, they actually are all very different, but slate and marble would be more closely related, and granite would be the odd one out. The slate is metamorphosed from fine-grained sedimentary rock, mudstone or shale, and it has the characteristic very dense what we would describe as fissile, which means it can break apart into a series of flat layers, because the heat and pressure oriented the clay grains parallel to one another and then compacted them very closely together. The marble is metamorphosed from sedimentary rock limestone, which is made up of billions of pieces of seashells and the bits of organic remains that are made out of calcium carbonate. And when you add heat and pressure to limestone, the fossils actually melt, and I'm putting that in air quotes because they never really attain a liquid condition. They change their shape and their crystalline structure into the crystalline form of calcium carbonate that has a sugary texture, which is what we identify as marble.
Did I catch some shade you're throwing on this idea of thinking about rocks and the way that they work for us as opposed to the way a geologist might think of them?
You know, that happens all the time, and I do have to throw out the idea that the building trades use these terms in a totally different way. If you've ever been to a decoration store and seen Vermont black marble as a countertop, that's not marble at all as a geologist would know it, but it's a term that describes a texture, a swirly texture that the presence of the fossils in the matrix give the rock. So the names mean different things to different people, for sure.
Well, I'm glad you're here because you can keep us honest and you can give us the geology, the sort of lay the groundwork here for these conversations that we're going to have as well about what each of these rocks has meant culturally and historically and economically. And so let's get right into it and let's bring Scott McLaughlin into the conversation. He's executive director of the Vermont Granite Museum in Barrie, and he joins us now to talk about schist. Just kidding. He's here to talk about granite. Scott, nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
So granite, you know, we've heard a little bit about this rock and how it's formed. And we've been now to Barrie and seen this Pluton, at least in our heads. So when did people in this region start to use granite for their own means?
So at the end of the colonial era, as people moved into what we call the state of Vermont today, they were unwilling to give up their bread, so they still needed some millstones in order to grind their wheat and their corn. And so they began looking for sources of local material to grind their material. And so granite outcrops appear all the way along the eastern side of the state from the U.S.-Canadian border right to the Massachusetts border. And local quarries started opening up in the 1780s right through to the 1830s. And that was the first function for the granite. They weren't commercial quarries. They were really just utilized whenever necessary to create another millstone for their local granary.
So it was all about stomachs to begin with, was
it
why we
was.
Were. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it became something else. Yeah, go ahead.
And then as the population began to increase and there were people with influence and money, they wanted to build brick homes and they wanted lintels over their doorways and windows out of granite, good durable material. Could support the strength, and then also steps, some facing around their buildings as well. And there's great examples of those all throughout the state from the 1820s on.
How were they originally getting granite out of the ground? I mean, the very early days, of course, we didn't have modern machinery. So how were they getting this deposit out?
So it is able to, you know, using good hardened steel, you can drill a hole in it and then hand split it with wedges. Most of the granite within the state of Vermont, the crystalline structure is aligned, so it is fairly easy to split in one direction, not so in the other, but it is possible to shape it through the smashing of the granite crystals made up of the feldspar and the quartz.
So, Scott, with more modern machinery, granite certainly was able to be quarried in much greater quantities. Can you just tick off some of the things that granite is used for and has been used for in the last couple hundred years?
Sure. So, as I mentioned, architectural elements is one of the first functions, as well as millstones. And then later on, you'll have monuments being created from the 1880s on, thanks to pneumatic tools, little jackhammers that kind of smash up the crystals and make it possible to shape it a little more effectively. There's a great big press roll that sits right outside the Granite Museum. It looks like a large rolling pin. Those, one stacked on top of the other, is used to create paper. You take your paper pulp and you just squeeze it between those granite rollers. There's also surface plates, massive granite slabs that are very, very smooth and designed to support sophisticated pieces of equipment. Also, you can take objects that are have to be absolutely precise in terms of dimensions, and you take photographs directly on top of those granite slabs. There's also the chocolate factories, starting in the 1870s, use granite rollers to mix all the chocolate ingredients to make it the smooth texture that we love so much.
So if you're thinking just, you know, headstones and countertops, granite is used for a lot more than just that.
That's correct.
How about now? How big a deal is granite economically to the state of Vermont now?
So right now we have about 24 manufacturers outside of the number of countertop companies, which is probably another two dozen. And those 24 companies probably produce close to $1 billion or so in products that are distributed all across the world.
What about culturally? Vermont, you know, really has been shaped culturally by granite over the years. I'd love for you to describe a little bit about that.
So the first immigrants that were coming to work in the granite industry are coming largely from the United Kingdom. They're coming from places like Scotland, southwestern England, as well as the kind of periphery of Ireland, which there's granite quarries that have been in operation for hundreds and hundreds of years. They came to work in the quarries and extract the material, largely making dimensional pieces and blocks. And then when we get to the 1880s, we have Italians that are coming to Vermont to work not only on the granite industry, but also the marble industry as well. And they start to transform the granite communities that are kind of scattered along the eastern side of the state. They bring with them completely different social and political and religious systems that influence the communities in which they live in. And for some communities like Barrie, the foreign-born population in the 1920s and 30s reached almost 40%. So they bring all sorts of foodways and things that ultimately impact the growth of communities. The Italians, they typically get the greatest nod when it comes to historical records. There's quite a few of them, but there's also Swedes and Norwegians. There's Spanish, French, Swiss that are coming here to Vermont to work in the granite industry as well. And each of them bring tools, technologies, and ideas about how to transform that industry and has made it possible for that industry to continue right to the present.
Char?
Well, I think some of the information we just heard also applies to the marble and the slate industries in terms of when quarries first opened and when they expanded. The marble quarries, the first ones in the Dorset area, were in the 1830s, but they went through their big boom and expansion following the Civil War, and it involved many of the same populations of Europeans. And if you actually look at what was going on globally at the time, that coincides with the period of, obviously, the Irish potato famine. But also the second wave of what are often called the Highland Clearances, which were the enclosure of property in the British Isles and the displacement of local farmers. And across Europe in general, this was a period of tremendous political and social dislocation. And it corresponds to a peak in immigration to the United States in general. And many of the early people that came to the quarries, for example, the Irish, were involved in actually building the railroads that serviced these what were going to become industrial centers. But at the time, they were still small agricultural communities. And once the railroads were developed, some of these same people, as well as the people that followed them, moved into the actual quarrying operations themselves. And that's what we see in the marble quarries in the Dorset area, as well as in some of the slate operations around Fairhaven.
Before we get into marble, I want to go to Keith, who's calling in from Rochester. Hi, Keith. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just was curious. I grew up in the Rochester area. My father, my grandparents, and great-grandparents before me, many of the family members worked in a quarry in Rochester that was very famous, the Verde, the Green Mountain Verde, greenish. Is that a marble or a granite?
Yeah, Keith, thanks for the question. Scott, what do you know?
It's a serpentine, although often confused with granite. It's a fairly hard material, but it's the way it's produced is completely different than granite.
Yeah, the serpentine actually fits back into that earlier story that I mentioned about how these three rocks formed during the 150-million-year period where the Green Mountains were built. The serpentine is actually a mineral that forms, or a rock that forms, from the alteration of ocean floor, what we would call a mafic and an ultramafic rock that makes up the actual crust of the sea floor. And little slivers of this ocean crust were incorporated into the thrust sheets that were squeezed into Vermont as these plates collided. And we're talking dimension stone and quarrying today, but if we went off in the direction of mining and started talking about talc and asbestos, those particular minerals and rocks are all associated with this metamorphism of these ocean crust slices that we find in very specific areas of Vermont.
It's all fascinating. And Scott McLaughlin, before we move on to marble, I want to thank you, your director, executive director of the Vermont Granite Museum. Thanks for sharing your knowledge with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Today, we're talking with UVM geology professor Charlotte Mertens and several guests who are sharing their knowledge of granite, marble, and slate. These rocks have played a large role in Vermont's history and economy, not to mention their effect on the Vermont landscape. And let's bring marble into this conversation. Here to help us with that is Nancy Kennedy. She's with the Proctor Historical Society, and Proctor is sort of the heart of the marble industry in Vermont. Nancy, nice to have you on the show.
Thank you.
So Vermont is rich in marble, and it's really from Middlebury all the way down to Dorset. And
yes,
Proctor, where you are, is even named after, of course, a very prominent marble industry family. Can you take us back to when marble first became important to the people living in the area and how it was used?
Well, of course, the Marble Valley runs from, as you said, as you mentioned, from just Middlebury into Dorset. And the widest area of this valley running down is about going through Rutland, which is about 6 miles wide. It goes from the Taconic Mountains to the Green Mountains on the east side. And But Proctor used to be part of Rutland. Proctor's original name was Sutherland Falls because of the large falls that we have, the very deep falls that we have here in town. And that one of the main reasons of the Marble Company was able to be so successful was the power from those falls.
So, go ahead, Nancy. Let me bring you here, too. So Vermont marble, we'll start with this, has a really strong pedigree. It's been used in some very impressive buildings throughout the country. Yeah, including the U.S. Supreme Court, the United Nations building.
That's right.
Can you tell us what is so special about Vermont marble?
Well, I don't know if I can or not. I think that the color is really very important. Most of these monuments in Washington, they like to have a white, and although it's not pure white, it's a creamy white, it's a good white. A lot of it is Dorset marble from the marble building. Although the Senate office building I have written here is Imperial Danby marble. So it's a very hard marble. It lasts and survives very well. I think those are probably the main reasons why, and also there's a quantity of it. They can take large orders.
You know, we actually got a question from the Shelburne Community School and Meg, who emailed a question in from the students. And Char Mertens, we'll ask you this one first. They want to know, does our granite and marble match the granite and marble from Europe? So as we're talking here about what might make Vermont marble so special, is all the stone the same or clearly not?
Go ahead.
Well, I'm not really sure what match means. If we look at the age of granite, marble, and slate deposits in this region of Vermont, we can trace them into other geographic regions, which right now seem like they're very far apart. But back when these rocks formed, they were actually clustered more closely together. And so we can trace similar rocks up into Newfoundland and then over into the British Isles and then ultimately up into Norway. However, the specific chemical compositions and some of the physical properties really do vary because those are unique to the very specific temperature and pressure conditions as the rocks formed. So to answer that question, I would say yes, they match, but they have very, very strong local characteristics.
Let's go to John, who's calling in from Windsor. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. My grandparents came over from Italy in the early 1900s to work in the, well, he did, my grandfather, in the marble quarry in the West Rutland, Ira area. And I was just wondering, there was like a lot of competing uses, as I understand it, of marble and granite. And I understand that the Lincoln Memorial and the Library of Congress and all that was made from Vermont stone of some kind, and that every monument in Arlington National Park was made from Vermont granite.
No,
and I was wondering, what is the what makes if I'm not being biased, but what makes Vermont marble superior to New Hampshire? Vermont granite superior to New Hampshire granite. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for your call, John. Now, so Nancy, you want to clear up the Arlington National Cemetery monuments?
Well, I've just been going through this because I've had a question about when was the first Vermont marble tombstone or headstone laid up. And I've even talked with men at the National Arlington Cemetery, and they don't know themselves. It's really very difficult. The first stones, they were not stones, they were wooden. And then about 1868, they decided that they would start as something more permanent, and so they had marble. Now, we just don't know where it came from, but we know it came from Vermont. It was Vermont marble, but we don't know exactly whether it was from West Rutland or whether it was from another town.
Yeah, go ahead, Nancy.
So even they don't really have an absolute record on it, although the man was very, very nice talking with me, and he said if he found the answer, he would call me back.
Nancy, is it true that there is sort of a turf war between granite and marble? I mean, we didn't want to put you guys on together in case it came to fisticuffs.
Oh, no. Well, of course, the marble company is here in Proctor, and my involvement with it is just, as I say, through the Historical Society. No, I don't really feel that I want to get involved in anything like that. Every job feels that they have the superior one, I suppose.
Well, I mean, you look at, too, granite is perhaps more durable, and so granite headstones seem to last longer than marble headstones, and the granite people will tell you granite's way better for a headstone than marble, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, they can say, I don't know. I'm not going to get involved in that.
Professor Mertens, what do you want to tell us about a marble and its physical properties?
Well, if anyone has ever toured a cemetery in the state, they know that there are really pretty much three types of headstones that are used. And so that's a kind of a nice field trip, actually, to do with students to talk about the relationship between the physical properties of these rocks and their longevity at the Earth's surface. There's no doubt about it. Granite is a very hard rock, and the Barry granite in particular is so uniform in its crystal size and structure that it's very easily sculpted because it behaves in the way you'd predict uniformly as you work it. But granite's heavy, and it has probably a higher cost of production. But if you look at headstones made of granite from the 1800s, the lettering is still sharp and clear and easily read. When you look at the headstones that are made of marble, beautiful as our expert is describing, beautiful creamy white color of it, that calcium carbonate composition, which is also very uniform throughout the rock, makes it really susceptible to the chemical weathering from acid deposition, whether from snow or rain, because rainwater and snowfall is slightly acidic. And so there's a chemical reaction that occurs between the rain and the rock that over time eats it away. And if you look at many of the memorial to our Civil War veterans that were put up in the mid-1800s, a lot of those letters are pretty much illegible now because of 100 years of this chemical weathering. But the marble is very soft and very easy to sculpt. I mean, there's a reason Michelangelo used it when he created his masterworks. And it is also not as heavy. And so when you're thinking about building, there are a lot more factors other than how long it's going to last. And one is, of course, the weight to size ratio. And that's actually a little bit of a good segue to slate, because slate is also very, very durable. And it is not chemically as reactive, and it, for its weight per unit size, is a lot lighter than either the granite or the marble. So it's really appropriate for using it for things like roofing.
Before we get into slate, Nancy, I just want to ask you one more question about marble. And I'm curious how you see culturally marble and the marble industries having shaped the state and your region.
Well, as the gentleman said before, the numbers of people, the immigrants who came in, were very large, and I think we had sort of more or less the same ratio of people. The largest number was for the 1920 evaluation of the immigrants into the town of Proctor was 235 Swedes, 140 Hungarians, and 129 Italians, and the other communities were lesser numbers. But of course, the Italians, they were the South Italians, and then the Italians that came from the Carrara era, who were all carvers, and they were a very special category in themselves.
Nancy Kennedy is a member of the Proctor Historical Society, and she's representing marble in our panel today. Nancy, thank you.
I'm not a geologist, and so I can't get involved in this kind of conversation.
Well, we appreciate you sharing your expertise with us. Appreciate that. And let us not shortchange slate here, because we do have to get to slate, one of the three rocks of Vermont. And Professor Mertens was just telling us about some of the characteristics of slate that make it good for things like roofing. Krista Roop is executive director of the Slate Valley Museum in Granville, New York, and she's on the line with us now. Hello, Krista.
Hello, how are you?
So, you know, slate, I think, doesn't quite get the same fanfare as granite and marble. Why do you think that might be?
Well, what we do say here at the museum is that there's a little bit of the Slate Valley everywhere in the world, because there are slate roofs on major government buildings, like the Pentagon. There are slate roofs on top of churches and universities and beautiful homes. So although it doesn't get the same fanfare sometimes, we do know that the slate from this area, from the Vermont, New York area, is coveted throughout the rest of the world because it's harder, and we also have the most colors here in the Slate Valley.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that. Vermont slate and the Slate Valley has like 12 different colors.
Yes, it's about 12 different colors. The most rare is red. Red deposits have been found in other parts of the world, but it's only quarried in the New York area of the Slate Valley. And we've been talking a little bit about locations and where it is. The Slate Valley is kind of within the Stone Valley of the granite and the marble. It goes from about Castleton, Vermont, down to Salem, New York. And then there's about a 7-mile strip across that it straddles the border of New York and Vermont perfectly.
We've been hearing that in the marble and the granite industries, these were major draws for immigrant populations to come to Vermont to work in these industries and the associated industries that sprung up around them as well. And that's true for slate as well. Was it similar populations of people coming from Europe to work in these industries?
We had a population of Italians, but the rest of the groups are different. The first group that came over, there were strikes in Wales, and they were doing quarrying there in the northern part of Wales, and American papers were actually, or American companies were actually advertising in Wales papers like "Come to America." These Wales populations were very skilled workers, so they were able to come in and assimilate very quickly into the slate mining company. After that, a group of Irish immigrants came, Italians, Slovaks, which includes Czechoslovakians and Polish, and a Jewish population. So there's quite a mix and flavor of different groups coming all at once to the valley to work in the slate industry.
And including your family, you trace your family history back to the slate industry?
Yes. My great-grandfather came from Poland. He came separately from my grandmother. She was in Detroit, and he wrote to her father and said, I'm going to become a success in the slate industry. I'm going to own my own quarry one day. I want to marry your daughter. So that's how my family got settled here in the Slate Valley.
And slate is so special to you that you want to dedicate your daily work to a museum that specializes in slate history and culture.
I love history, and this is we try to tell the story of the immigration trail, which is obviously, as a fourth generation slate family, is very important to me. We also tell the geological side of the story, which we're talking about here on the radio today. And we also talk about the industry and how it's changed over the years, both through technology and through manpower.
Krista Roop is executive director of the Slate Valley Museum. It's in Granville, New York. Krista, thank you very much for talking with us.
No problem.
So, Char Mertens, you talked earlier about how slate is lighter, so it's easier to use for roofing than, for example, to make the U.S. Supreme Court building. And you know, I think of slate and how it sort of, not sloughs off, that's not quite the right word, I don't think, but, you know, it breaks in straight lines, right?
Yeah, it's a property that we call fissility, or something as fissile, if it'll break along these flat sheets or planes. And because of how the slate forms from the compaction of mud, which a little grain of mud looks like a sheet of paper, very flat and wide, when you compact all of those sheets together, the rock gets very dense and impermeable to water. That's really why it's used in the way it is as a building material. And it can be handled, slabbed, and broken with a good chisel or with good techniques. You can break it into very thin slabs that you can then trim to the size that you want for your roofing material. But originally it was quarried for, believe it or not, for the slate tablets for kids to use in schools, and also for the what we call chalkboards, large slabs of slate. And it was after the Civil War, I think, really, that they moved into slate as a roofing material.
You know, we've been talking about these three different kinds of rocks, slate, marble, and granite, and they are the state's three official state rocks. Do you think they deserve that designation above all others?
Well, I'm a limestone fan, so I feel a little bit miffed that we got left out there. But, you know, I'll take the fossils, okay? But they are the three classic dimension stones, the material that is quarried in blocks or slabs of a particular size that can then be handled in a variety of different ways depending on what your final product is. So it's almost like saying that the state has a dimension stone, an official dimension stone, which are these three. But yeah, they're without a doubt, they've played a huge role in the social, economic, and the landscape of Vermont over the past 200 years, and they deserve that recognition.
Is it true everywhere, do you think, though, that geology really does shape culture?
Oh, totally. I have a seed of a project to do at some point down the road of comparing the different ways that particularly Western Vermont evolved culturally, socially, economically, compared with our friends across the lake in New York. And I firmly believe the differences that we see in terms of the social, economic, cultural differences between different sides of the lake there is totally driven by the differences in the geology, because that controls the soil. That controls the vegetation. It controls how you can use the land. I think it all comes back to rocks.
Well, consider yourself booked. When you finish that project, we would love to hear about it. Charlotte Martins is a geology professor at the University of Vermont. Thank you very much for helping us guide this conversation today.
My pleasure.